How was the world formed? Hello, this is Good Word. I'm Dave Thomas, your host for this quarter. We are talking this quarter about the question of origins or beginnings, how the world began. We are looking in particular at the Genesis account. I am happy to have my colleagues with me again, Bob Cushman, a paleobiologist who works in administration at Walla Walla University, and Alden Thompson, who is a biblical scholar here. Gentlemen, the Bible account, the Genesis account, talks about the world being formed, that at one point it was without form and void, and then in this story we have discussion of how God spoke form into the world and so forth. One of the questions that comes up about this is that is often recited, especially by creationists, has to do with this idea that our planet is a rare thing in the universe. In other words, are there any other places like this one? In particular, that there are a whole bunch of things that have to fit within certain parameters in order for life to exist here. I don't know, Bob, if you have any knowledge or thoughts about that that you might enlighten us with?
Well, we live in a special place. The combination of gases in our atmosphere, oxygen, nitrogen, and the amount of solar radiation that we receive are fairly unique to our planet, particularly in our solar system, but also in other solar systems that we're aware of. We are the place where the combination of these gases and solar radiation and other elements are unique enough to allow human life to exist. Mm-hmm. Now, from time to time, we discover on other planets or moons even, the water or some other gas that could contribute to life, but we have not yet found the particular combination that exists on this planet existing anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. I'm also interested, I've heard a little bit about temperature variations, you know, that actually we as human beings are fairly frail when it comes to temperature differences. We can only live between certain parameters, and on this planet, those temperatures seem to be just fine for us, whereas on other planets, the variation is so high, life could not, as we know it, could not exist. Is that your understanding?
That's true. And we think of the temperature extremes on our planet, you know, from the Arctic poles to, the equator as being fairly dramatic.
But, yeah, like from 60 below zero to 130 above or something.
Right. But when you look at other planets, the extremes are so much greater, usually at one end or the other, that life as we know it could not exist in those places.
And I imagine that our atmosphere moderates the distribution of those temperatures, because I was talking to a physicist friend of mine, and we were making jokes about banishing people to Venus or Mercury. I think it was Mercury. And he said, well, they would have to rotate very quickly, because with no atmosphere, the backside of the person would be freezing and the front side would be completely roasting because of the temperature of the sun. See, so I'm also intrigued by something like water, this is linked to temperatures too, is that if all the water on the planet froze, life as we know it could not continue. And so you would have to envision that throughout the history of this planet, as long as life has been here, there's been water that is at least in the liquid form. The reason I bring that up is that it does make this planet a rather distinctive place. It's not a very big place compared to the solar system, but it is a unique place, one that seems to be finely suited for life as we know it.
But what that means, Dave, is that it's all more mysterious. We don't know how in the world God did it. He simply hasn't told us those bits and pieces.
Yeah, and if you do adopt the position that we're here by chance, that the degree of luckiness is far greater than we imagine once you start looking at those particular parameters. I want to push us a little bit to the biblical story. We all know that the Bible story talks about 7 days of creation, and I thought we'd spend a little bit of time looking at the first three. And the first three, when you look at the story, the biblical scholars talk about it having a chiasm. In other words, that it's like it ascends up one side of a pyramid and then comes down the other to a point of resolution. And I'm intrigued by these first 3 days, because when you look at it, they have a relationship to the second 3 days in that it appears to me that in the first 3 days, God is creating different domains. Any comments on that, Alden?
Well, that's certainly the way the story is structured. The problem with that, we can accept that, but that does tend to raise questions about our chronological understanding of the story.
Yeah, but of course the people who wrote the story had no idea of chronology, of a little nice chronology for everything like we do, right?
No, in fact, when you get to the fourth day, where God creates the sun, moon, and stars, if you take that at face value, that would suggest that all the heavenly bodies were created on the fourth day. But you have the distinction between day and night on the first 3 days. So it's enough to give us just a touch of humility without, so we can't say with precision we know exactly what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. So this certainly was not written with a Western mind frame. This was written with an Eastern one, where I think the most important fact was stated first: in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and then it backs up and talks about how that happened. Mm-hmm. What do we say about the time in which all of this activity took place? Do we want to take up that subject here today, or is there nothing constructive we can say about it?
Well, when you go back to the biblical story, it was Archbishop Usher who first came with the specific date for creation and the flood. And there was a time when his dates, starting with 4004 BC and the flood at 2348, these were actually entered at the headings of each page, which gave people the impression, well, this is something that's included in Scripture. But the Bible never gives us precise information on the age of the earth, but that 6,000-year figure has lingered long.
Mm-hmm.
Within the Adventist community, Ellen White seems to make a point of it in her early writings, but when she comes to Patriarchs and Prophets, the book she wrote in 1890, interestingly enough, all references to the 6,000 years disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So she seems to be not making a point or an issue of that. And if we recognize that the Bible doesn't address the issue of how long it is, that at least resolves some of the questions that we might have in terms of how science relates to creation.
Yeah, so in other words, if you have an idea of when creation took place, it's because you applied human reasoning and some system to the Bible and therefore came to a conclusion. Mm-hmm. It's not laid down in the Scriptures themselves.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. What do we make about this idea of old rocks and young life? I mean, is there some pre-existent time? Is it credible to argue that this planet, the stuff of this planet might have been here prior to God's creative activity? Not that he didn't create it in the very beginning, but it seems like the biblical account maybe speaks more to creation of life on this earth than to the creation of the whole universe. And some people probably won't like that comment. But any comments about that? Is it, we have all these old rocks and we have relatively young life, it appears.
If one looks at the modern dating techniques that science provides in looking at the age of the earth, it's difficult for me to think about old rocks and young life in the sense that those same dating techniques are used on rocks containing life in them, if you will, in the form of fossils. And you would expect those techniques, if they're valid, to be more valid the younger the rocks get. And yet, I do hear frequently that people say, well, because of radiometric dating or some other scientific reason that they believe in an old Earth, young life approach. Now, that is one way that people do try to resolve some of the conflict between science and Scripture. But for me, I think that it is lacking in the sense that there needs to be some consistency if we're going to use the modern dating techniques to say the original Earth is old, the rocks are old, then those techniques ought to be valid for those same rocks or rocks that are younger that contain life in the form of fossils.
And that's not as clear-cut as some people would like it to be, in other words.
Correct.
Yeah. Wow.
There's another point from history that I find really intriguing. that if you look at the time where we can verify human life in the sense of history, is that both in Mesopotamia and in Egypt, you have full-blown civilizations coming about almost out of nothing between 3,000 and 4,000 years before Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were thinking of a gradual—
Or maybe a little before that even, 5,000 years?
No. Nope. Babylonia, about 4,000, and Egypt, about 3,000, and they are fully developed.
Okay.
Now, to my mind, the way of thinking that if it were evolutionary, you'd think they would gradually develop. But that's not what happens.
But they come fully developed.
They come fully formed. And in evolutionary terms, that's just yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. And what about the Indus Valley? And in China, we have civilizations that simply, from what I understand, have the same kind of characteristic, that they suddenly appear pretty well formed, you know, 4,000 BC, something like that.
So I don't know about the other Asian ones. I'm thinking more of the cradle where the Bible itself was born, and that's Egypt and Mesopotamia.
I wanted to throw something in here a little bit. I've been spending some time with what's called ontology. The ontology is basically an idea of how you perceive reality. And it was interesting for me to notice that in the religious world, there seem to be about five of these. One being the idea that everything is random. That idea is not sustainable because the minute you try to explain it rationally, you just destroyed the theory. Another one is one that undergirds animistic worlds, where you have all these spirits out in the supernatural realm that are malevolent, they're out to get you, and you use magic and divination and all kinds of mysterious sacrifices to keep the spirits away from you. Another one is that there is no supernatural realm, there's only the real world, which of course would undergird the idea of atheism and so forth. The fourth one is an ancient one that sees a supernatural world and a natural world, but that the one is ideological and the other one is real, that the spiritual world is over against the material world. The material world is bad, the spiritual world is good. And so you have this idea of a soul going back and forth. And then the fifth one is the one that I think is the biblical one, which envisions a supernatural realm and a natural realm. The one is the domain of a creator, and the other is the domain of the creature. And in this particular ontology, you would expect that the cardinal sin would be for a creature to try and usurp the rights and prerogatives of the creator, which is precisely the story we have in the Bible. But I find these fascinating because there are so many competing ideas of how reality exists that it might be good just to think about that one. Well, gentlemen, thank you. Our time is winding down here for today. We again skimmed over some pretty big stuff here today, but I thank you for at least participating and opening this discussion. My thanks to Chad Ofterhaar, our engineer, and my thanks to all of you for listening. For Good Word, I'm Dave Thomas.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.